This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither wildly as they slip away across the universe.
31 years ago on December 8th, John Lennon was shot and killed on the sidewalk in front of his home. Reams of words have been written about that senseless, irrevocable act. Writer and critic Tim Riley prefers the parts of John Lennon's stories that are not so well known. His quest is for the deep and lasting meaning of four lads from austere post-war Liverpool discovering rock and roll.
The Beatles' accomplishment is so big. Everyone knows it's so big, but what is that accomplishment about? These are really four Liverpool boys who were so smitten by American rock and roll. And when they appear on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1964, they are just full-grown masters of the style. That's part of what blows America away about it.
The Beatles!
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you.
America continued to be blown away by the John Lennon they knew. Riley writes about that John and peels back new layers of the man in a book called Lennon, The Man, The Myth, and His Music. An NPR critic and Beatles scholar, Tim Riley spent years traveling to Liverpool and other places to speak to those who knew John Lennon. From his research, he composes a warts and all portrait of John Lennon from the world that made him.
The history of rock and roll as he heard it was very different than what most Americans heard. When he started listening to rock and roll in 56 and 57, he could only hear it one night a week on they called it offshore radio. It was basically illegal radio, and the signal, you had to listen to it at night. It was coming from Europe and 1 hour a week, and his friend Pete Shotton said, he expected all his friends to tune in. It was a religious thing. It was like it was so exciting and new and fantastical. And the more research I did, I realized that Britain has a totally different history of the 50s than America has. America's 50s are full of abundance, and Britain is in a period of what they call austerity Britain. Mm. They're still paying off their war debt and rationing food. To be from Britain in the 50s was to really be an outsider, like more of an outsider than we can imagine right now.
John Lennon says that before Elvis, there was nothing. Suddenly, it was like the Messiah had come. So something got released in this scrimping economical culture. And some of those myths about John growing up become sort of standard lines, like that his father abandoned him, for example. You write about it slightly differently. What did you find?
It really is an abandonment, but it's much more complicated than a simple abandonment. He was not present for most of young John's first 5 years, and then he shows up quite suddenly and picks the 5-year-old John up at his Aunt Mimi's house, where his mom has stashed him, and he takes him off to Blackpool for a holiday. To the young 5-year-old John Lennon, to go off on this holiday in Blackpool was this most magical thing that could have ever happened to him. Well, what we learn is that Alfred was actually planning to kidnap him and take him to New Zealand, which presents this fascinating parallel universe. If Lennon had gotten kidnapped to New Zealand, we might have had New Zealand Beatles. And apparently it almost happened, because it was a couple days before he was about to leave that Julia, his mother, shows up and tracks him down to come pick him up. But it's this very complicated scene in the front room of this house in Blackpool. Alfred very much wants to get back together with Julia, but Julia is determined to take him back home with her new boyfriend, Bobby Dykens. And there's a standoff. They can't decide what to do, so they call John into the front room and they say, okay, you have to choose now. Are you going to go off with your dad to New Zealand or back home to Liverpool with your mother?
So he was 5 years old at this time.
They put this question to this 5-year-old kid. Now, everything that I learned about Lennon up to this point tells me that he was a very smart, sensitive kid, and I think that he understood that the question was loaded and unfair, and that his experience of his parents was that they handed him off, both parents. And so he goes to his father first, sits on his lap, but he watches his mother get up and walk out of the house and down the street. So he watches his mother essentially give him up. And that's too wrenching. So he races down the street after her, and he doesn't see his father again for 15, 18 years. He goes back to Liverpool, and she indeed installs him at her sister's house, and he's raised by her sister, his Aunt Mimi.
It's such a dramatic scene. You know, this sensitive child grows up to be a kid who loves rock and roll. Julia, his mother, completely supported his love of rock and roll, bought him his first guitar. but he's also kind of emotionally frozen when she is killed, sort of stamping a pattern of an emotionally shut down person. How do we reckon that with the extreme sensitivity and ability to touch human beings through his music?
Right. So this is the core duality we have. We have somebody who suffered immense traumatic loss, like more loss than I can certainly conceive of by the time he's five. And then there's more loss to come, obviously. He loses his mother when he's 17. He loses his best friend, Stu Sutcliffe, a couple years later. So he's a very angry young man, but he's also extremely sensitive. So he does kind of channel all of his passion into his music. And I think that's what we hear in especially a lot of the early tunes, where there is this great sense of abundance and good cheer, which is simply his joy of music making, his joy of finding a path, his joy of finding an identity, a role to play in life through rock and roll. And then ultimately, if you listen to that early rock and roll closely enough, you start to hear these strains of darkness, of the loss, the pain. And he ultimately works his craft so well, he flexes that creativity muscle so well that he's able to express a great deal of pain by later in the Beatle career and then the solo career. It's an exercise in how to form an identity through the music in a much deeper level.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that early rock and roll from the Beatles from the early 60s. Let's listen to the song If I Fell. This is from the soundtrack of Hard Day's Night.
So I hope you see that I would love to love you. She learns we are two, 'cause I couldn't stand the pain, and I would be sad if our new love was in vain. So I hope you see.
That's John Lennon and Paul McCartney there, of course. Do I need to even back announce these songs? These are so deeply embedded in our consciousness. But a duet there. Talk a little bit about that partnership between John and Paul, which was fraught in some places and in others just an extremely beneficial gift to all of us.
He meets Paul at a church dance in Liverpool and is immediately intimidated and kind of impressed with the young Paul, who pulls out and plays an Eddie Cochran song on his guitar for him to kind of audition. And he decides to take him into the band, and they are fast friends. They have a certain kind of blend as duet partners in their own music and in other people's songs that just really is very special right from the word go. And this duet conveys many, many things, but most of all it conveys just great love of partnership and love of the music itself, this really intense, intimate bond and fraternity that you just don't get almost anywhere else. And then they do help each other find and form their own identities through the music, and that's their key project. And then slowly across the Beatles' career, what you hear developing in that blend is slowly growing apart as friends outside of music. Their lives begin to take on these incredibly different paths, and they choose these very different women to marry in their late 20s. And yet they still sound great together. So when we get to late duets, later songs like I've Got a Feeling or I Dig a Pony or Don't Let Me Down, then we have these really interesting twilight duets where they still sound great together, but you can tell they're kind of waving goodbye to each other. And the music really kept them together, I think, a lot longer than almost anything else could have. I think they had a terrible time breaking up, and I think that shows in the way they behaved and the rift that formed between them that became a big legal battle. They both go off into their solo careers with their wives. So this has always struck me as a statement that they both consider music making a profoundly intimate exercise, and that they had a profound intimacy together, Lennon and McCartney, and that to go off and make music as solo artists meant they wanted to bring their new intimate partners right there with them on stage.
But the relationship between Paul and John post-Beatles, what was that like? I mean, we get a lot of rumors of public sniping, whispers of near reconciliation. Were they ever close to writing songs together again?
I have some really interesting testimony from members of a band that John Lennon worked with in 1972, the Elephant's Memory Band. And I had one member of that band tell me that it was really typical that Paul McCartney would ring up for John Lennon in the middle of a rehearsal. Lennon would take the call, and the band would take a break for an hour while they listened to one side of this conversation between Lennon and McCartney on the other end. So this is a completely common occurrence, and they sit and talk for an hour about all things family, music, catching up. These band members told me they sounded like the best of friends. Now, this is during a period where we know that their lawyers are being pit bulls with one another and fighting, really, one of the great epic legal battles in music publishing.
We're going to take a short break and continue the conversation with Tim Riley, a Beatles scholar and author of several books about music. His newest is called Lennon, The Man, The Myth, and His Music. Stay with us for more of a portrait of Lennon gleaned from conversations with those who knew him. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Oh, please believe me. I'd hate to miss the train.